Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. This program is going to be a little different. I'm going to take the opportunity to speak with several very knowledgeable, thoughtful, courageous individuals about the kinds of challenges this country has faced in the past and is facing today when it comes to the enemies within and the magnitude of the threat that they pose to us. This has been the subject of a new column by a journalist by the name of Eli Lake, published at the Bloomberg View, under the headline, Trump's Coming Witch Hunt Against Political Islam. I personally feature prominently in this attack, and others associated with us do as well. I want to drill down on the charges that Eli Lake makes, I believe recklessly, and assess why it is that this particular journalist and so many others are determined to ignore or downplay, at the very least, the threats that are manifestly obvious, and so vilify people who are trying to warn of them. To begin, we're going to pick up with our regular feature, Diana West. Diana has, among other things, done as serious an analysis of these sorts of questions as any living American, certainly that I'm aware of, notably in her extraordinarily important book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can find her writings now at dianawest.net. She's a longtime syndicated columnist and always a valued guest here, most especially to talk about Eli Lake's warnings of a political witch hunt. Diana, welcome back. Good to have you as always.
Thank you, Frank. Wonderful to be with you and discussing this extremely important subject.
Well, it is extremely important, and I'm delighted especially to have the benefit of your counsel on this because you have studied so closely the history of these things. And the term political Islam, of course, is one that could be swapped out for other targets of witch hunts. Talk a little bit about this whole notion that if one seriously assesses and tries to counter threats, domestic as well as foreign, this constitutes McCarthyism or witch hunting. Just give us some of the history here, if you would.
Yes. Well, it's very important because we have been denied that history, which is essentially what my book, American Betrayal, seeks to begin to restore to the American people. And that basic thrust of that history that's been denied to us is that, yes, we do have enemies domestic. The triumph of so-called McCarthyism in terms of being a weapon against investigating our domestic enemies has been to essentially erase the very concept that there may be subversives working for foreign or subversive enemy hostile interests who are burrowing by stealth into our very fabric of the nation, whether it's in the actual taxpayer-funded government or other institutions. This is what the Congress and the FBI and many important journalists and other observers and keenly affected Americans were looking at in the period following World War II in particular. But this infiltration began much earlier. And indeed, when we go back to the 1930s, we see the House Un-American Activities open, led by Representative Martin Dies, a Democrat of Texas, to examine what was going on with foreign ideologies trying to subvert and indeed overthrow our government. And in those days, what he was looking at primarily was Americans who were affiliated with communist groups and at that time Nazi Bund groups who were secretly, or even not so secretly, working inside the federal government.
Yeah. And Diana West, was there any question that that was in fact happening? Did the Dyes House Un-American Affairs Committee actually find evidence of those enemies domestic operating on and in some cases inside the United States government?
Absolutely. I mean, here is what we're looking at in the period of the Nazi-Soviet Pact, when Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia were allies before World War II. The United States Congress passed several measures designed to enable the FBI to look at federal employees. Again, this was a notion of the idea was that subversives working to overthrow the United States government should not actually be funded by the taxpayer working inside that government. I mean, it seems like a fairly obvious concept. Yes. So the Congress passed, and remember, this was even during the Roosevelt days, so this would have been a Democratic Congress. They passed legislation that allowed, or that actually tasked, the FBI to examine the affiliations of federal employees involved in either Nazi Bund activities or various communist group activities. And what they ended up with, certainly in terms of the involvement with communism, was much more widespread. And what they ended up with was a report that included, and I will give you the exact number, 1,124 names. And this would have been a federal employees involved in many of them in multiple communist front organizations. And among these names were even some of the most famous spies we only later, much to our tragedy, were able to expose in the aftermath of World War II, including people like Alger Hiss. Imagine if an Alger Hiss and a Harry Dexter White and others who were exposed at this time before World War II had actually been ousted from the federal government. But what happened with this report, the FBI did its report. It compiled some 5 volumes of indeterminate length about the activities of these various employees, which went lost. And then by the time we become allies with the Soviet Union, the pressure from the Roosevelt White House is such that the entire enterprise is over. You are no longer allowed to consider communists anything but allies.
You mentioned this Congressman Martin Dyes, a Democrat, who did much of this work long before Joe McCarthy turned up. Recall for us what Martin Dyes told Joseph McCarthy when he, the latter, announced that he was going to take up the cudgel and try to figure out what was going on after World War II to assess communist penetration of the United States government. It's a really important message for all of us in this fight at the moment.
Yes, well, this is an amazing moment that took place on Connecticut Avenue at the old Harvey's restaurant, right around 1950. And we're looking at a meeting, a chance meeting at the restaurant between Martin Dyes and Senator McCarthy with his then fiance, later wife. And he happened to see Dyes and he went up to him and told him that he was contemplating investigating communism. And this is something that Martin Dyes wrote about in his own memoir. And he says, Joe wanted suggestions and advice. Now, this is, to me, was such an amazing concept of these two men meeting at this point. Martin Dyes had been vilified for years, all the years he was chairman of the House Un-American Activities Committee. And so in this period after World War II, as Joe McCarthy was preparing to embark on his investigations, which I should add, were not unique in the sense that there were many other investigating committees in the House and the Senate also doing the same good work of patriots, trying to find out who had entered this government and subverted it to Moscow's ends. I mean, this is essentially what they were looking at. So anyway, at this moment, Dyes tells him, I told him of my own experiences and warned him to expect abuse, ridicule, and every known device of character assassination and mental torture. I told him to move cautiously until he was sure of his footing, to beware of unsupported charges that would soon be flooding his offices, and never underestimate the cleverness and resourcefulness of the communists and their fellow travelers.
Diana, we have to leave it at that for the moment. But thank you for this important reconstruction of what happened at a critical moment in our past. We're going to talk next to Trevor Loudon about what is happening in our present and how it really informs, or at least should inform, the debate we now must have about dealing with these enemies, foreign and domestic. Diana, thanks as always. Keep up the good work at dianawatts.net. Come back to us again soon. Trevor Loudon, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a distinct pleasure to have with us as our guest for this segment, Trevor Loudon. He is, among other things, the editor-in-chief of the New Zeal blog, but he's also the creator of a series of products dealing with the topic that is very much on my mind at the moment, and most days for that matter, the enemies within. That is the title of a new and very powerful documentary, in which I must say I have a cameo appearance, but his very compelling rendering of the story of how the communists, the radical left more generally, their fellow travelers, the Islamic supremacists, and others are posing authentically a threat to this country from within is incredibly powerful, as are his books Barack Obama and the Enemies Within, and the Enemies Within Communists, Socialists, and Progressives in the U.S. Congress. Trevor Loudon, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Oh, look, thanks for having me on, Frank. It's always a pleasure.
Hey, we've been talking with Diana West a little bit about the history of this problem, of those enemies domestic, not just foreign, and the danger that they pose. I wanted to get just sort of an overview from you as to whether you consider that to be a problem in our time as well.
Look, absolutely. As Diana West has very well pointed out, the Soviet Union, through its more than 500 spies operating in Washington, was really dictating Franklin Roosevelt's foreign and, to a large degree, his domestic policies as well. They were running the country to a degree. So that problem didn't disappear in the 50s. You've had enemies of the United States have always been mounting influence operations inside your country, co-opting some of your more vulnerable congressmen and senators and executive branch personnel to get the policies they want enacted by your government.
Trevor Loudon is our guest. He hails from New Zealand, where he learned a thing or two about communist influence operations, and he has brought what he learned to bear in a careful study of what's happening in our own country, most recently put together and made accessible to all of us in the form of The Enemies Within. You can find that at theenemieswithinmovie.com. We're actually going to be doing a screening of it in Washington tomorrow evening, and I'm very pleased to have him with us to talk about his research. Trevor, you were just describing the fact that this is a phenomenon now of the what I think is best described as the red-green axis, working despite very profound differences between them on some points, the hard left and the Islamic supremacists to our great detriment. And what evidence have you found these people actually engaging in a conspiracy to that end?
Well, you know, those who doubt that these conspiracies exist, you only have to look at the Holy Land Foundation trial of 2008, when there are now five people languishing under long prison sentences for working on various Muslim Brotherhood front groups to fund Hamas, to funnel American money to Hamas. You know, that this is proven in court. You know, people are in jail because of it. But if you look at, say, say you look at someone like John Conyers, who serves on the Judiciary Committee, is the ranking Democrat. Now, he has worked both for the Communist Party and for the Muslim Brotherhood to gut America's internal security operations. He was the one who basically closed down the House Internal Security Committee back in the 70s. And now he is working as hard as he can to make sure the Muslim Brotherhood Terrorist Designation Act is not passed.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, Trevor, because
he's an influence guy.
Yeah, well, and he's not alone. I wanted to ask you about another individual who you profiled in The Enemies Within. And by the way, there's now a short clip of it as a freestanding product at YouTube. But talk, if you would, about the man who is standing for election to be the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, currently the progressive caucus chairman in the House of Representatives, Keith Ellison.
The argument in the movie is that there are approximately 100 members of Congress and 20 members of the Senate who are so enmeshed in radical Islamic supremacist fronts or communist fronts that they couldn't pass a security check to drive a school bus. But Keith Ellison is the epitome of that, and he shows exactly how far the Democratic Party has moved into radical realms. Now Ellison worked with the Maoists in the Nation of Islam when he was a student. He was a member of the Nation of Islam. He then was involved heavily with the Communist Party USA. He held fundraisers in the home of the leader of the Minnesota Communist Party. Communist Party phone bank has helped get him elected. He's even written for the Communist Party website. But he's also been heavily involved with Muslim Brotherhood front groups like CARE and MAS, the Muslim American Society. There's some fantastic photos that the Daily Caller has just dug up showing that MAS funded Keith Ellison's Hajj, his pilgrimage to Mecca, in 2008, and there's all sorts of photos online of him standing with, you know, in Saudi Arabia with all sorts of Islamic characters, the Islamic Development Bank and other shady operations. So Keith Ellison is intimately involved in the two major totalitarian movements of the last few decades.
This guy is the poster child, really, of the red-green axis, Trevor Loudon, and I'm so pleased that you've helped bring this forward in terms of the information that every Democrat who would vote for him for chairman of the Democratic National Committee is on notice. That's the kind of guy you're trying to have lead your party. Let me ask you about one other thing. An enabler of these guys, as you've done so much to document, Trevor Loudon, and your wife Victoria for that matter as well, is the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's recently not only been campaigning against me and others on our team, but has been promoting this meme that there's all kinds of hate crimes now breaking out as a result of Donald Trump's elections. What are the facts there?
Well, look, this hate crime thing is completely bogus. As you say, my wife has investigated their report. There is not one substantiated report. There's not one court case, not one conviction. All it is anecdotes culled from the internet, you know, people complaining something on Facebook or whatever. It's completely 100% bogus. There has been no upsurge. But this has been picked up by all sorts of mainstream media outlets as some sort of legitimate report. It's a complete lie.
Well, and unfortunately, it's characteristic of the complete lies that the Southern Poverty Law Center now purveys routinely. And Trevor Loudon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. But I do want to say, as one subjected to a lot of their calumnies, as are you, I think it's incredibly important that people recognize this is a disreputable and discredited organization, the SPLC, not one that should be taken as gospel.
One of their main lawyers is a supporter of North Korea, Eunice Cho, you know, a former member of the North Korean Support Committee. and she's one of their main lawyers. So that gives you a flavor of where they're coming from.
Calibrating the SPLC is a full-time job. Trevor Loudon, thank you very much. We look forward to the screening of the film tomorrow night, The Enemies Within. Check it out, folks, at theenemieswithinmovie.com. Come back to us very soon, if you would, Trevor Loudon. My colleague Jim Hansen joins us. We'll talk about why Eli Lake and others seem so concerned that Donald Trump is taking to heart the work of the Center for Security Policy. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Very pleased to say we're joined by my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, frequently the host of this program in my absence, Jim Hansen, our executive vice president, a former Green Beret and man who has been deeply versed in and active in trying to protect our country, as the oath of office he took obliged him to do, against all enemies of our Constitution, foreign and domestic. Jim Hansen, welcome back. Always good to have you with us.
Glad to be here, Frank.
Look, I'm talking in the course of the program a bit about this hit piece that Eli Lake of Bloomberg and the Daily Beast wrote about me personally, about the center, about our team more broadly, in connection with the efforts we've been making to expose and call attention to some of those, well, enemies domestic. And I wanted to invite you to talk a little bit, Jim, about that work and why efforts by Eli and others to deprecate it as, witch hunts and the like are so misplaced and so insidious.
Well, Frank, I think it should be undisputable to anybody with an above room temperature IQ that there is a threat. I mean, there are people at Ohio State who would swear to that from firsthand knowledge of what happens when you let unvettable Islamists into the country. So I don't know that there should be an argument about whether there's a threat. Now, when we get to what the threat is, that's where there seems to be a fairly concerted effort to make a very surface level apology for the threat as it actually exists. And so when you say that there's a danger from Sharia adherent Muslims who believe that the U.S. Constitution should be secondary to Islamic law, that's poo-pooed by these people. And they say, oh, well, that's just a small collection of radicals. And they don't actually mean that. You know, it's really more of a social code, and it's more like Orthodox Jewish law or something like that. And the problem is, if that's widespread enough, it becomes common knowledge, and that surface level examination does not take into account the scholarly work folks like us and others in the business have done for decades, pointing out that that's not what they're saying, even in public sometimes, but certainly not in private. So that's the real danger, is that when you get into making these, pure apologies for a very insidious and dangerous threat, you minimize it and you cause the public to, in many cases, too many of them, to believe it's not the threat it truly is.
You know, I think the public, by and large, gets this, Jim. Surveys that have been done by others as well as by us have affirmed a greater awareness of the danger and just plain common sense about the nature of it, its relationship to the Islamic traditions and doctrine of Sharia, even if people are not deeply knowledgeable about all of their particulars. They are concerned, particularly when they hear the government of the United States say this has nothing to do with Islam. There's no sign of terrorism. This is a lone wolf acting on his own and all that. Whether it's at the Ohio State or whether it's the shooter at Orlando or the folks at San Bernardino and on, there's an awareness that I think Donald Trump spoke to very powerfully and was in part elected to address. And I'd like you to ask you to talk a little bit, Jim, about what we've come to call, I guess, the victory over jihad strategy that Trump espoused very explicitly, ran on, notably from August of this year when he laid it all out in a major address on the subject.
Well, Frank, it was obviously the culmination of, as I said, decades of work, but we boiled it down to a number of things, again, that, as you mentioned, the American public seems to get if the elite media and the others do not. One was a very simple concept of stop importing jihadists. I always love when you say we've got enough already. And apparently we have too many already. So the idea that we should be wholesale allowing migrants and refugees from places where we know jihad is in effect, when we cannot tell the good guys from the bad guys, is absurd. It's dangerous, and it's national security malfeasance. Another component is curing what Andy McCarthy, who you mentioned and who is one of the foremost legal minds in combating this, called willful blindness. The government took the idea, starting in the Bush administration and to absurd levels in the Obama administration, that Islam is not a problem at all. Now, whether it's the whole religion or, as we put out, a significant portion of folks within that religion, it is a problem. So you can't ignore that and then expect to keep the country safe if you do not allow our national security apparatus to take that into account in any way. And that's the willful blindness that he talks about. And I think that right there, if you wanted to look at the first two pieces of a powerful way to start changing what we're doing, you have to take those things into account.
Now, this is being described by Eli Lake, and I'm sure others will now start repeating it like a mantra, as a witch hunt or as some kind of purge or vendetta against people simply because they're Muslim or are associated with political Islam, which is a sort of euphemism for this idea that you can, indeed must, because Allah directs you to, impose Sharia over the entire world. I just wonder, Jim Henson, as you look at what Donald Trump talked about in that speech most especially, in which he, as you say, he said he was going to vet people rather than let them in willy-nilly. He said he was going to try to end this willful blindness. He also talked very explicitly about this ideology at the core of the problem, the Sharia, he called it, that is clearly, you know, the thing that you need to filter against, it would seem. To the extent that all of that is true, and I believe it is, and I think you do as well, do you anticipate that President Trump and his administration will be now discouraged from pursuing this critically important program on the basis of these kinds of preemptive attacks by folks on the left or their Islamist allies?
No, I don't. I actually have a fair amount of faith that despite this effort to discourage them, and it is a significant effort, it is well-funded, it is well-organized, and it is well underway, I don't think they're going to succeed in that because Trump doesn't care what they say. He ran on a platform of listening to the American people and hearing their legitimate concerns. You know, the difference between a witch hunt, as this was characterized by Eli and others, and what we're undergoing, which is a counter-jihad, is there aren't witches turning people into newts. There are jihadists slaughtering people in the streets. That is a pretty significant difference. So calling it a witch hunt is absurd on the surface, and worse yet, it attempt, like I said, to stop Trump. He's not going to. I think he will do things such as limiting incoming migrants and refugees from dangerous areas. And I guarantee he's going to take the handcuffs off law enforcement and our national security apparatus and allow them to do their jobs as they have been forbidden from doing for the past 8+ years.
And you know, Jim, that really is the great scandal here, is all of those who are now caviling about what Donald Trump might do and the threats to civil liberties that it represents have turned a blind eye to the danger posed to not just civil liberties, but to our constitutional republic by people who have had this as their agenda Either the Islamists themselves, most obviously the Islamic supremacists, but also their leftist allies in what has come to be called, and I think properly so, the Red-Green Axis, as we were discussing it with Trevor Loudon a moment ago. This is a critical moment. Your service to our country, Jim, both in uniform in the past and that you're rendering as the Executive Vice President of the Center for Security Policy these days, is critically important. Thank you, Jim. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Kenneth Timmerman, an astute observer of the political scene, about his take on all this and more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Ken Timmerman, one of our time's best investigative reporters, a man whose cumulative works in the journalism space, as well as an author and an activist for freedom and democracy in Iran, makes him truly a Renaissance man. His work on the Iranian front, by the way, actually earned him the nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize at one point. He is the author of, most recently, Deception, The Making of the YouTube Video Hillary and Obama Blamed for Benghazi. He is always welcome here. Ken, I'm delighted to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Frank.
Hey, I've been talking throughout the program about a hit piece that was done by a chap by the name of Eli Lake, who I think you know, having worked in these vineyards for some time, as has he, in which he talks about a political witch hunt against political Islam that may be coming as a result of the Trump election victory. I just wanted to get an independent assessment from you as someone who has been both investigating and reporting and writing about the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamic supremacism more generally for decades. In your professional judgment, Ken Timmerman, is it the case that there's just some wild conspiracy theory here, or is it actually a matter of fact that the Muslim Brotherhood and, for that matter, other Islamic supremacists, including those of Iran, have been actively working to influence and, where possible, subvert the government and constitution of the United States?
Well, Frank, look, of course they are trying to subvert our policies and subvert the constitution, and they say it. The political Islamists say it openly. Political Islam is the problem. It's not Islam the religion. It is those who are using the supremacist doctrines of Islam to impose Sharia here in the United States and around the world. Here, look, I can focus in on one very specific thing to give you an example of this. Look at how throughout the United States government, from the State Department to the Department of Defense to the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, even the Police Department of New York City, the NYPD, how they have removed all teaching about the doctrines of political Islam and how that could help counterterrorism professionals to identify potential terrorists, such as this 18-year-old Somali boy who went on a knifing spree in Ohio, and he was identifiable if we had looked at the signs. They removed all of that and replaced it with this doctrine called countering violent extremism, which is a completely meaningless phrase. But they did that on purpose. So the United States government, our counterterrorism apparatus, the FBI, the people in customs and border enforcement would not be looking for the political Islamists seeking to infiltrate this country and eventually, potentially, to do us harm.
You know, when you point this out, again, there's this endless refrain that, that's just a conspiracy theory. But I think, as your own documenting has shown, this is no conspiracy theory. This is a conspiracy. Hey, speaking of which, Ken, one of the things that got sort of the back of the hand treatment by Eli, but again, I know you've gone to school on, is Huma Abedin and the extent to which she is, in fact, an example of the kind of people who have ties to these Islamic supremacists, if not actually being one herself, which is open question. But having an opportunity to serve at the highest levels of the United States government and influence policy, surely that's something that serious people would want to examine closely and rigorously, wouldn't you think?
Well, that's the point, Frank. We don't know whether Huma Abedin herself is a political Islamist. We don't know that for a fact, because as far as I'm aware, the FBI has never done that investigation. They've never done an counterintelligence investigation on her, even though she had the highest security clearance and had access to, you know, above top secret documents as Mrs. Clinton's top aide at the State Department. But she certainly should have been subjected to that kind of examination, given her family background, given her own personal involvement with an Islamist magazine for many, many years, and the fact that, you know, her first job after leaving Saudi Arabia was going to work as an intern for Mrs. Clinton. So she did not have any other record besides working for Mrs. Clinton and working for an Islamist publication.
I know you've been focusing on, as many of us have, the nominations President-elect Trump has been making to various positions. One that is still outstanding as of this conversation, Ken Timmerman, is for the Secretary of State. You probably, about as well as anybody, certainly in the Fourth Estate, understand what a challenge it will be for President Trump to have the State Department working for him instead of against him. How critical is it that he have, as the secretary of that department, someone who is absolutely locked down solidly on his own team?
Well, I mean, it's critical, Frank. You've got to have somebody who understands that the bureaucracy is going to be out there with their knives drawn, and that anybody who goes there in a political job, in other words, assistant secretary and up, had better be wearing body armor facing backwards, and that better be ready to defend their boss. And their boss is the President of the United States, Donald Trump. I've done several pieces about this recently, one in the Washington Times, another one this past Tuesday at the Daily Caller. And I recalled an anecdote that I had heard in 2004. I had included in my book, Shadow Warriors, about Colin Powell, who was Secretary of State during that election in 2004. He held a big pep talk with all the employees of the State Department saying, okay, the election's over, Bush won, now it's our job to go out and enforce his policies. And an assistant secretary went back to her office suite, locked the door, told her 125 employees, if it hadn't been for a few thousand votes in the state of Iowa, we'd be talking President Kerry right now, and it is not our job to carry out policies that we believe are not good policies. That's called insubordination, and that's the kind of thing that this president is going to be facing at the State Department, and why he needs a very strong Secretary of State who supports Donald Trump's policies, not his own.
It is almost unimaginable, I'm sure, to most Americans that the whole department isn't fully preoccupied with promoting this country, making it great again, and the like. Do you anticipate that the president will find himself absent such a strong and committed supporter as his secretary, facing the kind of not just insubordination but subversion, really, of his policies at every turn that I remember very well from the George Shultz State Department when I was in the Reagan administration. And, you know, you can go through the Jim Baker and Colin Powell and Condi Rice periods as well.
Right. Well, absolutely. But here's the thing. I think Donald Trump is a different kind of president than George W. Bush was. I think he's somebody who understands management decisions better than Bush did, and he understands people or policy. I've been very impressed so far by his cabinet picks. I think he has put together a team who are entirely on board with his positions, and he's made some politically incorrect choices. You know, starting with the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, who's been, you know, they tried for a week or so to try to demean him and to smear him as being a racist and all kinds of other things. And there he is still holding his head up high and smiling. I think Donald Trump is going to pick somebody for Secretary of State who will be his man, and he will make sure that his people are at every level in that department to make sure his policies are carried out.
From your lips to God's ears, Ken Timmerman, thank you so much for joining us as always and for the superb work you do, Ken, in so many different ways. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same as well. Tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.